Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I'm your host, John Orlando, and I imagine many of you are probably saying, where the hell have you been, John? Yeah, I know it's been a few weeks since I have dropped a new episode, and the life of a podcaster is sometimes very, very tumultuous. I had some folks lined up, and then they had to drop out because of some personal concerns, and we had to rearrange schedules, and before you know it, I was left without a guest. So it's taken me a little bit of time to get back up in the saddle, if you will, and ready to drop some wonderful ear candy that is called the PVD Cast. Well, let's talk about my guest. Yeah, my guest is Rich Trask, and he is an artist. He's very good with the pencils, the paints, and even the camera. That's right, he dabbles in photography. But anyways, he's an artist that has done some really interesting stuff, some really cool stuff through web comics, web cartoons, some comic strips, and even right now is working on a project for Nyx Comics. So Rich and I are going to talk a lot about comic books and a lot about art. So it's a fun episode. It's a very enthusiastic episode, I guess you could say. And it's the episode 100. I mean, you know, I didn't think 4 years ago I would ever get to episode 100. And that's right, coming up here at the end of the year will be 4 years. Oh, man, this blows my mind. It really does. But it's been a blast. I wouldn't change it for the world. But all right, enough of that. I'm just rambling a little bit. I don't really think there's anything else I really want to touch base with. Over the 2 weeks, I'm racking my brain to try to think of anything cool that happened. Of course, August 28th, I visited Old Wrestling, and it was another fantastic show in Norwalk, Ohio. Lots of smiles in the crowd as I sat up in the bleachers and watched the show. Nobody had a frown on their face, and you know what? That's what Marion Fontaine and Old Wrestling brings every single time. They bring fun, they bring excitement, and, you know, hats off to everybody affiliated with Old Wrestling. Great show. I think the other thing that was noteworthy, I think, for me was I watched TNA Wrestling's Delete or Decay. It's another one of those weird, off-the-chains, Matt Hardy, I don't know, mini-movie you want to call it? I don't know. This one was all right. I enjoyed that they incorporated in a few of the zoo animals. I mean, seeing Jeff Hardy fight with a kangaroo was actually quite funny. So so there you have it, ladies and gents. I mean, you know, there was a couple WWE pay-per-views, but they were kind of, you know, I don't know. Not really noteworthy, I guess. Yeah, I did watch the UFC pay-per-view last weekend where CM Punk made his debut. And, you know, obviously it's not the debut that he wanted or what many wrestling fans were hoping for. But I guess the bottom line is the guy went in there and did it. And, you know, you can say whatever you want about him. How many people pursue their dreams? How many people try to achieve their goals? And he tried to do it. So, claiming that there's going to be another few fights in his future, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But, really, that's about it. So, let's not waste any more time, if you will. Let me throw it to a very quick break. And on the other side of that break, you'll hear my conversation with Rich Trask. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the PVD Cast. John Orlando here, sitting down with Mr. Rich Trask. How you doing, Rich?
I'm all right. How you doing?
I'm not doing too bad. Not doing too bad. So, you are an artist, a photographer, a citizen of Columbus.
Sure.
What other titles would you like me to add on to your name?
Well, that's probably
Lord of the Manor.
That's probably way too many already. Well, I don't know. I'm just sort of a knock-around guy. I don't know. I mostly consider myself an artist. I dabbled in photography for a while, but never really went too far with that. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I still like doing that. But
well, I think one of the things I noticed with just kind of looking at a couple of the things that you have online, your portfolios, if you will, would it be safe to say that you're a big comic book fan?
Yes.
Because, I mean, that comes through. There's a lot of, I guess you could say, homages to Captain America, yeah. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, who were some of your favorites growing up?
Oh, well, Captain America was huge. Hulk was big.
I was gonna ask literally. That because you have your own Tumblr page for the Incredible Hulk.
That's right.
Okay, so what about the Hulk? Why do you gravitate towards him?
Well, you know, I think as a kid, I mean, the TV show was big, but even before that, I really like the idea. I mean, it's a power fantasy, obviously. You know, if you're in a situation that you need to get yourself out of, and that's sort of the beauty of the Hulk, is he's not really out to hurt anybody when he transforms. He's really just in danger, and needs to find a way out of it, or it's just a matter of people are bugging him.
Yeah.
And so he becomes this creature, you know, causes some havoc, but for the most part is looking to get away. You know, he's looking to just end whatever situation he's in. And then, you know, I related to that a lot, especially in school. You know, I always had sort of a social awkwardness issue. I've, you know, been bullied and whatnot. And so the Hulk always sort of, you know, I related to that. Just the idea. I remember having sort of several, you know, daydreams, as it were, about him, just being able to just go crazy, to just become something big and scary, and just, you know, exact some sort of revenge, even if it's just, you know, making kids piss their pants, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is an honest, true story. That TV show used to make me piss my pants. Like, I shared this story recently. Of course, I was 3, I think, when the show came on. But man, there was something about when Banner turned into the Hulk,
right,
when Bixby turned into Ferrigno, that just freaked me out. I ran for the couch every time. And I think I only got to watch like a couple of episodes because my mom was like, no, you're not watching this. She had the good sense to say no. But yeah, that show used to scare the bejesus out of me.
Wow.
And now I look back at it.
Well, I could see how that's scary, but I never... you know what scared me was the $6 Million Man.
You're kidding me.
I don't know why. There was just something about the idea of a guy with a gouged out head that had a mechanical bits and pieces. You know. And when they were doing that surgery bit and the opening cuts, we can make him bigger, we can make him stronger. That skull and that beeping and that. I was like,
really?
Yeah. And the fact that he ran slow to, you know, it was supposed to be sort of, he's actually running fast, everybody, but he's running slow so you can see him. But it was just like, I was so creeped out by that for some reason. I had the doll, too. I got the doll.
Oh,
He had bits of pieces that came out of his arm. And
right.
Something.
So that further traumatized you. That's what you're saying. That further traumatized
you. Exactly. In fact, one of the dolls had like skin on the arm that you roll up.
Yeah.
And then you could see the mechanical parts. And then there was a guy who could take his face off, and he was a robot.
Right, who was never in the TV show either. I just learned that.
Was that
not
right?
Not too long ago.
I seem to remember some kind of robot.
Well, they had other ones,
like
but
there was a woman robot that could take her face off.
The actual action figure, and I don't remember its name, and maybe somebody, if you're listening to this at home, you could tweet me what the name is, because I forgot, but that was specifically just for the toy line, because there was really no recurring bad guy on the show.
That's
true. Really, and it's true, because it was always rotating.
It's always just like a lot of European spies. Stuff like that,
European spies. Aliens.
Yeah.
Andre the Giant is the Sasquatch.
That was pretty cool. I like that. There was those people who could run, weren't they like ghost people or something? They all wore the same outfit, but they would like go across the room or something.
You know what? I'm gonna be honest with you. You got me on that one. I don't remember that episode. I've seen a handful of them, but I don't remember that one.
Yeah, it was like that one weirded me out quite a bit too. As I grew older, it became a little bit more.
Sometimes
hilarious.
Things don't hold up.
Yeah.
Well, I remember as a kid, like, Dukes of Hazzard was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And then I remember, like, in college, I think TBS or TNT started showing them. Yeah. I'm like, yes! And then I watched them, like, this is the stupidest show ever. I cannot believe that as a kid I loved this.
Although I liked Boss Hogg and Roscoe, when they would have their little conversations, which I heard later were mostly ad-libbed between the two actors. Yeah.
Really?
My fat little buddy and all that kind of stuff. Those are hilarious, but yeah. I did not have that sort of respect for them back when I was a kid. But as later on, I was like, oh, boy, there's a lot of hilarious stuff going on.
Yeah, I just.
It's like everybody in the show was just like, who cares? It's a show about a car.
Yeah, in essence, it is. It is.
Let's just have fun with this.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So back to comic books. So you like the Hulk? You like Captain America? Were you strictly a Marvel guy?
Well, obviously, everyone, I think, starts off as Superman, Batman.
Yes, sure.
You know, those are those kind of, you're sort of bombarded with, especially in the 70s when I was coming up. But I remember specifically reading, I got a copy of Spider-Man, and it was one of the Spider-Mans where there was a spider buggy that I guess Johnny Storm had built, but someone else had taken control of it. I want to say it was like Mastermind or something like that. And I thought it was really, I just remember having, it was like two issues. And I remember reading them like thinking, well, why is he not friends with the spider buggy? Why is the spider buggy attacking Spider-Man? And then just the idea that there's a spider buggy, you know, in the 70s, dune buggies and stuff were kind of the rage. So there's a spider buggy and he's got to flip over it and he's doing all this kind of stuff. And he finally gets the best of it and crushes it up and hangs it somewhere, I think. But I remember specifically going, that is weird. That is some crazy story. Not wasn't the kind of typical story you'd see in like Superman and Batman. Superman, especially then, was still like, you know, I'll take care of that. No big whoop. You know, something's going on. What is it? Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Let's figure that out and I'll take care of it. Batman sort of similar was like that, but Spider-Man was just, there's just something weird about Spider-Man. And he had the, you know, strange face mask and the whole thing. So that, I believe, is right when I turned the tables and started really following the Marvel. I think I was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 possibly when that transpired. And I kind of left Superman and Batman behind. It wasn't until later on that I reexamined Batman and Superman and started sort of seeing what else was below the layer. But it was always Marvel that I sort of attached myself to from that point on.
What was the first, do you remember the first like introduction to comics? Was it like, was there, like for me, I have an older cousin that was into comics and he kind of introduced me, but then along came G.I. Joe and that just was it for me. So was there a point that you can recall when you said, yeah, this is the stuff for me?
Well, right, it must have been because I remember the first time drawing stuff.
Okay.
I had a character that I drew called B-Man, and I think I just assumed to do a superhero, there must be a letter on his chest. So just pick a letter.
Pick a letter.
I picked B. It had nothing to do with the insect. It was just the letter B. And he was like this sort of blocky guy with, you know, the stick legs and so forth. And he had a cape and a B. And so there must have been, that's my earliest at least memory of being able to draw.
Okay.
Drawing anything like that. And it was clearly a, you know, Superman ripoff. So I guess that's where I could probably, I can't, you know, pinpoint exactly when comics were big for me, but I think drawing this B-Man, essentially Superman, was where I sort of clicked in.
Okay.
And I never really looked back. And in fact, me and comics have had an on-again, off-again relationships. There's times when I've, you know, really been heavy into it, and there's other times where I sort of dropped away.
Was that because of other personal things going on, or was it because I think a lot of people get disgusted by the over-marketing of it.
Yeah.
I mean, was it...
Well, in the 70s, it was when I really started following, or trying to follow things, it was a lack of access.
Yeah,
I mostly just had my brother's comic books, and they had a lot of weird, sporadic things. They had, like, Devil Dinosaur, and I remember that specifically being, and that was another Marvel comic that was just so peculiar.
Yes.
That I just loved how weird it's like, this is big red dinosaur with this hairy guy riding him. It's just, this isn't Superman. But it was lack of access. But by the time I got probably in the 80s, I think, I remember I was hanging out with my friend Tom Hartley, and he was an avid X-Men fan. So I started reading some of his X-Men books, and it was during a time when they were something like the Dire Race were involved or something like that. But the artist was Barry Windsor Smith, and I remember this. I remember looking at the art and saying, man, this is actually really incredible. There was a shot of Nightcrawler, and he had the Cerebro helmet, and just this look on his face. And I said, I never really had seen that in comics before. There's just real kind of odd theatrical intensity going on, and it was really drawn well. So from that point on, me and Tom became sort of comic buddies.
Would that also be the time when Claremont was writing, or no?
I believe so.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, he was writing for quite a bit.
Right, throughout that early 80s and into the almost, that's 86, 87, I think, is when his run ended. And he was a phenomenal writer, too, so he had the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and I remember John Romita Jr., started drawing. Mm-hmm. And that's really what comics are for me. I didn't really follow characters as much as I followed artists. Mm. So when I really started coming into my own, I started, like, you know, I always liked John Byrne's Fantastic Four, and then was doing Alpha Flight. Mm-hmm. And Alpha Flight I really connected with because I kind of thought I was the only person who discovered it.
Like you were in on the underground, on the ground level.
Yeah, no one knows about Alpha Flight. I'm the only guy. This is all for me. Crystar was another one. Do you remember Crystar?
I do. Was that not, like, refresh my memory, I think Crystar, wasn't it had something to do with, like, Magma Men or something like
there
that?
There were, like, it was sort of like, you know, Lord of the Rings, except there was this curse put on these two camps.
Yes.
They used to be all together, but then they got split apart, and one got turned into Magma Men, and the other got turned into Crystal Men.
I remember that. Crystal Men, not Crystal Meth, by the way. If you misheard, Rich said Crystal Men.
Crystal Men, absolutely. But yeah, I remember that, and it was a bi-monthly. No, it was when I say bi-monthly, that's every other month. Right?
Yeah, I think
it was
so.
Like every second month, and I begged mother to go take me to the Readmore bookstore to see if the new Crystar was in. Because it seemed like it took a long time for it to come in. But it was Crystar and X-Men and Micronauts.
When they
did a second run of Micronauts and stuff like that. But that's when I started following Micronauts because of Kelly Jones, who was... Is that who was Kelly Jones, the artist on Micronauts? But he was a big...
I think so. I'm going to be on... There's another one. People, you can tweet at me. Let me know if you got that wrong. Kelly Jones. I want to say Doug Mensch was the writer,
That sounds right.
For Micronauts, but I don't know who the artist was. I got to be honest, Rich. You got me on that one.
That's all right.
So we'll go with Kelly Jones.
Yeah. But he had this really interesting style and, you know, elongated legs and bulbous things and stuff like that. So when I got into comic books, it was really because I liked the artwork. Mm-hmm. You know, I really just... And so when, you know, things started going downhill with X-Men, I kind of moved on.
Gotcha.
When Alpha Flight changed hands, even though it went to my, you know, one of my big favorites, Mike Mignola, I had never heard his name said out loud. I swear he himself told me his name was pronounced Mignola because I saw him at a Comic-Con, and it was strange because he had not yet come out with Hellboy, and there was no line in front of him. It was like John Byrne, and I got him to sign my She-Hulk graphic novel, and then Mike Mignola, or Mignola, whatever it is, and then Roger Stern was there, I think, but no one was at Mignola's table, so I started talking to him, and I said his name, Mignola, but he says, oh, it's actually Mignola. It's like sign, Mignola.
Oh, see, I always thought it was Mignola myself. Yeah. That's,
well, it should be. How it's spelled. But then I knew about him because he had done a couple of issues of Cloak and Dagger.
Oh, yeah.
And really? Because Cloak and Dagger was being drawn by another guy, like, inked by Terry Austin, but who was the... Oh, Rick Leonardi, who I really liked. And, but then Mike sort of took over for him for like two issues or something. And I really thought it was stunning. And so I started following his work as well.
So let's talk about your own pursuit of art.
Okay.
So when you've been an avid fan of comics, and as you just gave us a quick overview of how you found it very beautiful and you were interested in the art. Mm-hmm. So was that a passion of yours then? So through high school and that, you were just totally into art and that?
High school, I was, all through school, I was always drawing Superman and stuff like that. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, the kids would crowd around you. And there was, you know, occasionally I would draw like a guy, and some guys would be weirded out by, you know, I'm drawing a man, I'm drawing muscles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was sort of this homoerotic thing in their mind, apparently. Not in mine, but that didn't come till later. But But yeah, I was always sort of known for drawing. And in high school, it really kind of got big.
Did you get formal training in besides your art classes in high school, or was it just you trial and error, man? Trial and error.
I drew all the time. I would draw during class. I would get in trouble for drawing during class and stuff like that. So yeah, I just kept drawing and drawing and drawing. And high school was big because that's where I met my friend. Well, actually, I met Alan Patterson in middle school, but then I met Robin Reed and John Proffitt in high school, and we did a sort of a satirical humor rag, as it was called The Darker Side.
Okay.
And I started doing comics for that. You know, first it was like editorial cartoons, and there was a few things there.
For your high school or for like the local community?
Just
or
for ourselves.
Just for yourselves,
And we were sort of underground. We were sort of trying to play that, you know, where, you know, you know, what's the term I'm looking for? Anti-establishment, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Even though we weren't really anti-establishment guys. but it's actually Alan Patterson who ended up rooming with Ken Epstein when they went to college.
Oh, okay.
And then flash forwarding, you know, I think 47 years by now. When Ken was starting up Nix, Alan told him about me, and then that's how that all
Connected. Well, let's talk about maybe one of those very successful team ups with Ken. You had a long run in Columbus Alive with Diabolical X.
Diabolical X.
So maybe for the listeners at home, could you give a brief summary of what that comic strip or cartoon was about?
Well, essentially, Diabolical X. It started as a because I did a website with Robin Reed, who I knew in high school. We did a darker site called Bean Monthly. His nickname is Bean. And it was something called Dr. Luft Morgan, lawyer detective, who you never saw in the comic strip. It was just sort of a spoof on those comic strips you'd see in the dailies that never made sense, that you would only read like every other day or something, and nothing ever gelled. So everything was out of context. But I did a character called the Masked Diabolical, who was just very angry at Dr. Luft Morgan for, you know, ruining something. And at the last strip was, you know, so he's railing against, he's going to tear Dr. Luft Morgan apart. He hates everything about him. He's going to grind his bones into dust. And then he realizes it's 10 o'clock, I better call the wife. He's he's just this guy who... who sort of likes the idea of being a villain, but the reality is he's a really good guy.
Okay.
So when Ken was doing sort of these 6 week at a time Columbus Alive strips, he asked me to do one, and he said, because he had seen the Dr. Luft Morgan, I had put some on Facebook just for fun, and he had seen the Masked Diabolical and said, "Let's maybe you should flesh out that character."
Okay.
And I said, okay, and I had some ideas, and basically, like I say, the Diabolical X is a guy who wants very badly for everybody to be nice.
Okay.
So he's sort of this villainous guy who's going to take over the world and force people to be free and live happily and do the right thing.
Okay. All right. How many weeks was that? Was that 6 weeks?
Six weeks.
Was it well received?
Yes, quite well received.
Good.
In fact, I did want, because he would go through certain places in Columbus and he was like sort of trying to put together his headquarters, his army, you know. So he would see various things around Columbus and decide, that would be a good place for me to get my uniforms. That would be a good place for me to pick up this or that. So I did one on the North Market, where he's sort of praising the North Market for the way they do their, you know, economically, you know, respectful and responsible and all that kind of thing. And the North Market saw it and actually wanted it blown up and put on their wall. So right now at the North Market, there's one episode of Diabolical X where he goes to the North Market. That's it's up by the on the mezzanine by their sort of corporate office.
Okay, you know, whatever. Okay, I know where you mean. I know on that mezzanine. I know there's I can't remember what end it's on, but that's cool, man. That's
Cool. And a lot of people seem to seem to enjoy that, and that's sort of what led to that Columbus Monthly shot that I did.
Right, which I have to ask, are you a juggalo?
No.
By the way, we're talking about,
good segue, though.
Thanks. We were talking about my friends, the Juggalos, which were in the Columbus Monthly, which, so how did that project come about? Could I just ask real quick?
Cause, well,
since you're not a juggalo. And
no, not yet, anyway.
Well, you know, as a side note, I often make fun of them because, I mean, it's so easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
But a small part of me does give a lot of credit to those two guys because that's got 15 minutes of fame written all over it.
Yeah.
And they've turned it into like 20 some odd years and millions of dollars on like no marketing. Mm-hmm. Like, where have you seen ICP at on your right. way? There's no billboards on the way here to the library, right? So part of me gives a little bit of respect, like, yeah, damn, you guys have done it, man.
Yeah, they're sort of the Piper of the disenfranchised.
They are.
And when I was doing the thing, I did a little research, and I listened mm-hmm. to some of their music, and I was like, boy, this is weird stuff. I mean,
it's not my cup of tea. It's not my cup of tea.
But I mean, there's one where it's like they're questioning everything, but there's another one where it's just about a chainsaw murderer. So they're like all over the board, and they have interesting things to say, but that's enough about that. But when they asked me to do this, it was based on they already had the story in place.
Okay.
And they interviewed this woman who worked at a Shell station who's nearby the Juggalo event.
The gathering, it's called. Out in Thornville, yes.
And she sort of had several run-ins with the Juggalos, but lovely people, apparently, based on her sort of observations. Like, okay. They were, like, really respectful to her. They mm-hmm. sort of had their own sort of law amongst okay. themselves and so forth. So I did a lot of research. I looked at a lot of pictures and stuff like that. And, articles about mm-hmm. other gatherings and stuff like that. And there was a lot of that. There's a lot of sort of crazy drug use and sort of
debauchery.
Debauchery, indeed. There's a lot of nudity apparently going on. It almost makes you wonder why not just peek, see what's happening. But I don't know. But the point was there did seem to be sort of this interesting... they lived by an interesting code that mm-hmm. wasn't really out to hurt anybody. It was mm-hmm. really just about weirdos getting together to be weird.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I thought that was interesting, but...
And was that strip well-received as well? That cartoon was well-received?
I haven't really heard
much
about it. Diabolical X did lead to that. The gal had talked to Ken, and he suggested several artists, but she saw what I was doing with Diabolical X and thought that was interesting and liked that, so she wanted me to... I can't remember her name. I believe it was Beth something, but she's the art director of Columbus Monthly.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Can we talk about a couple of the other cartoons that you've done? Because I have a couple questions on a few of these because they were good. The Family Load.
Oh.
Which.
Wow, that goes way back.
I know. I've done my research, Rich. I don't want to brag, but I found it fascinating because I thoroughly enjoy the fact that Not Me actually was devious because he was so lame.
Yeah.
Like, who broke the vase? Not me.
You know,
okay.
It's that classic family, well, who's this Not Me person then?
Yeah, but you made him taking a crap in the middle of the living room floor, which was awesome.
That was actually me and my friend Robin Reed and my other friend Larry Marriott. We were all talking about the family circus and that how that Not Me character would. And then we just talked about all these terrible things that Not Me could. So there's literally... Who took a shit in the floor? It was Not Me. And there's Not Me taking a big... I don't know. Are we allowed to swear on this
thing? Yeah, go ahead. That's fine. Yeah, he took a shit. Yeah, that's fine.
But my favorite was... And Larry came up with this. It was who borrowed a new car... And it was Not Me, but he'd wrecked it into a tree and was lame, dying.
He just
this crazy bastard of a ghost thing just stole this car and wrecked it, and then he's bleeding on the side of the road. Not me, and there's this.
Yeah, and also unplugged grandma's breathing machine at the hospital. Grandma. Yeah, so I like that because I don't know. Family Circus, I always found to be incredibly hokey.
Oh, definitely.
Incredibly hokey.
And then whenever anyone does parody Family Circus, it's always sort of that sexual kind of innuendo kind of thing.
Sure,
so I thought our idea was a little bit more sort of...
It's a different take on it.
Yeah, a different take.
How about Quicksand? Because did anybody, like, did PETA get in touch with you? I mean, you in this comic strip, the dog drowns every time.
Well, his name is Quicksand, a dog that always drowns. That was
your defense. Hey, PETA, it says it in the title. Yeah. What the hell?
They named him Quicksand for a reason. But, that was when we were doing Bean Monthly.
I
was coming up with web cartoons like that. But that one was just... off the top of my head, just this idea that, you know, and there's always the Lassie trope where, save me, dog, save me. Yeah. There's quicksand. And so in the comic, Timmy, who goes by several names, Timmy, Jimmy, he keeps getting renamed. I don't know if you noticed that.
But he did not actually.
He just dopily jumps into this pond and then can't swim. So he asks Quicksand, Quicksand, save me. So here comes Quicksand and he's paddling to the rescue but then drowned.
But you didn't take any flack for that? Nobody, not really.
No one gave us anything about that. But, you know, and then like the next episode was Quicksand drowns in the toilet, drinking out of the toilet.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
He just keeps drowning, so maybe that's what saves it, is the fact that he comes back, he just keeps
drowning.
He's
like Kenny on South Park. Exactly. He keeps coming back. He's
rejuvenating. He just continually drowns.
Okay, the last one that I want to ask about is Timmy and the Space Monkey. First of all, Rich, I don't know if you know this, but there's now an indie wrestler by the name of the Space Monkey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
is that
and
right?
He wears an actual space suit, like his tights are a space suit, and a monkey mask.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
So, what was the inspiration behind Timmy and the space monkey?
I always liked.
Again, those. This was from Bean, right? By the way,
that's right. Okay. That was from Bean. We did like two or three of those, and then when we had the paper version of that, which was called the Liberty Laugher, there was several other. There was one where Timmy and the space monkey meet Santa Claus. And they accidentally kill him, and so they have to be Santa, but then they decide being Santa sucks. But regardless, it was based on those old serials, old movie serials, where, you know, there was a Rocket Man or there was some other. But in every one of those, for the kids, I guess, to relate to, there's always a kid and a monkey. And even Speed Racer had a kid and a monkey. And I like the idea of, let's just make it about the kid and the monkey. But in this case, the kid's kind of a dick, and the monkey knows it, but the monkey can't, like, really communicate, so he's this very passive-aggressive monkey. So they're out in space, and they're part of this sort of the space force, and they're out to just, you know, do things, but no one really likes them, so they've been put out in Sector 88 where nothing's going on. But, yeah, space monkey's essentially this kid and this monkey who travel through space, and Timmy is kind of this jerky guy, and Space Monkey hates being around him, and they somehow make it work.
Yeah, there you go.
There's one where they're attacked by a space bear.
I think that was the one that I read. Yes, the space bear.
They're attacked by space, and Timmy's attacked by the space bear and Space Monkey, because every animal in space has to be called space bear.
Right, exactly, yes.
So Space Monkey saves him, but by shooting the bear with a gun, and then he's just so upset with Timmy. He's looking at Timmy, who's all cut up and ripped up, and he just can't help himself, so he decides to shoot Timmy, too. Why not? He's out in space by himself. Then it turns out to be all be a dream, just as, you know, just to appease the children. But
well, I think that was the theory, too, with, like, a lot of the sidekicks in comics, too, was that the children needed somebody.
Exactly.
You know, Robin was the urban legend behind him. You know, they needed somebody to
I mean, they
know,
all had one. Sure. Bucky, Captain America, and the Black Terror, who was, like, the most frightful idea of a character, had a little teenage guy.
Really? I did not know that. Really?
They're murdering Nazis together, and they're on this drug that makes them, you know, super powerful for like a limited time, and they're just murdering people, and it's just this dude and his kid.
I did not know he had a sidekick.
Yeah,
I know very little. I saw in several of your art pieces that the Black Terror, and I will confess, I'm a little bit. I vaguely know a little bit about him. I was unaware that he. So he takes a drug. Is that okay? And who put that out? Was that DC or was that one of those like Whitman?
I think it goes way back to those sort of
to those. Older
yeah,
comics.
Back when Marvel was called Timely, and right, that kind of stuff. Just everybody came out with, you know, a character like that, and especially during the sort of the war era.
So he took drugs?
Yeah, he, I think there was a powder or there was a mist that he would inhale, or I think sometimes, but see, when I thought about it, and this is sort of what you might be referencing, I sort of did a redux of, I know that's not how you say redux, I just like
saying Yeah, well, that's fine.
of Black Terror as just sort of this, basically he's an intravenous drug user who gets this powerful, you know, sensation. It's like, you know, a junkie, but he's a superhero.
Okay.
And his drug is being a superhero, and he takes this drug to be a superhero. But, yeah, the original Black Terror did take some kind of, and this was, you know, back when Captain America was exposed to, Super serum and Vita-Rays and all that kind of stuff. So it went hand in hand with that. Back then, it seemed, you know, there was elixirs and liniments that you would take to be to get powerful and vim and vigor and all that nonsense.
Well, hell, they had it in real life, you know. Yeah. I mean, in that time,
it's
essentially
booze.
Yeah,
but, you know.
Booze. Yeah, exactly. I was gonna say Dr. Whitman's miracle elixir. Exactly. You know, I mean,
but that was sort of Black Terror's deal. He took this weird drug. Now, later on, when they did it for, I think Atlas Comics did a take on him. I think he's currently public domain, so anyone can do him.
Oh, right.
But, but they would make him sort of more of this sort of Superman-like character. But I like the old days when he was, like, breaking necks and all this kind of thing.
He's often missed
he's
and then breaking necks.
He's just out of his mind.
I'm just going to throw that out there. We're halfway through this podcast, but I want you to be prepared. I think that we're going to close out this episode with a quick question of if you could have dinner with five.
Oh, man.
You already are like, shit. John, I hate you. I was going to say, five creators, who would it be? Hmm. So I'm giving you the heads up now.
Okay.
All right? So you can ponder that as we continue to talk. So even though you're already like... Man.
Nah, okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
But we'll get to that.
Well, okay. So let's talk a little bit. One of the things I wanted to ask about is I know that on, and I forget what Tumblr page it was on, that you had some photography there, and particularly some really interesting shots with Matchbox cars.
Mm.
So number one, you're obviously like to... dabble in photography.
Mm-hmm.
So, was that another hobby that kind of you were self-taught? In terms
pretty much. I have a friend named Cynthia DeGrand who is a photographer.
Okay.
And I worked with her on a project and really sort of got into things, got into it, and really thought it was a fascinating process. And she was still doing the traditional photography where, you know, you'd use film and you would, you know, develop it in a dark room. And it was really fascinating stuff. So from that point on, I sort of got into it. I mean, not in any serious way, but I just sort of like to play around with it and stuff like that. But yeah, I like that. And I always like to I like to pick up Hot Wheels cars. I'm not so much Matchbox, for some reason, aren't as interesting as Hot Wheels. Like, Hot Wheels is like the Marvel of diecast cars. There's just something extra weird about Hot Wheels. They're always doing kind of weird stuff. Matchbox is like fire truck, station wagon, dump truck. Whereas Hot Wheels is like hot rod, weird paint, hatchback, or whatever's going on.
Yeah. Well, I always found Matchboxes weird because a lot of them were European, so they had the steering wheel on the other side. Like the little plastic, the interior, when you'd open the doors, you're like, oh shit. It's a BMW, but it's got a steering wheel, you know.
That's interesting. I don't know if I ever...
I have a few like that. I have a couple Matchbox cars. Like, they're always Europeans. They're like Mercedes or they're, you know, there's never like a Ford that has it on the other side. But yeah, so... And weird... What was the other weird one? There was a weird tanker truck that I had that had... It was a European gas. So I'm like, I don't know
like
what
it
is.
Esso or something
It was Esso. Thank you. It was. It was like really weird. So... But so Hot Wheels, so you and you just kind of just started taking pictures of those.
Well, I like
kind
the idea of taking pictures of super small things.
I was that was the one I was going to ask about because it seemed like I remember there was one where it's sitting kind of on a keyboard of a computer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that transpose of.
Yeah, I like to try to arrange them to so that you know they're somewhere small. But I'm trying to take a picture of like. I'm trying to take a picture like it's an actual size car, but, you know, with the angle or whatever, try to get as close as possible and so forth and get the lighting like that. But I still want there to be a reminder somewhere in there, like I'll put a pen or I'll put a keyboard's a big one, or a phone cord was another one. It always looked really interesting. So, yeah, that was sort of a series of things. And the first few came out really, really good. And for some reason, I can't quite capture that magic. But yeah, I've continued to do that.
I was going to ask, you still dabble in it?
Yeah.
And that's
in fact, I'd like to start. I have a Flickr page that has all my Matchbox or Hot Wheels shots, but I want to do a Tumblr at some point. But I'm not the only one. When I'm researching it, it turned out there's a page called Matchbox Porn, which it's just you could just. you know, donate your shots of your Hot Wheels or Matchbox cars, and people are taking them up on cliffs by sunsets and stuff like that. There's no actual porn happening, just the idea that everyone's so involved in there.
I think that's the hashtag for this episode on Twitter. That's all. I'm going to write it down right now. That is going on Twitter. Matchbox.
Yeah.
Cars. Porn, right? That's what you said.
That's
right?
What I said. I said it out loud.
Okay. Yeah, it's public record now. We can't put the genie back in the bottle, people.
Yeah, and I'm in we're in a library, so I think legally obligated for that to be a standing term.
That's right. No
Once
one's going to
say something
that.
In a library. It becomes official.
What's some projects you got coming up?
Well, Ken's got another project that he's got me working on. It's mm-hmm. sort of another Western.
Okay.
It takes place in a train. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's going to be kind of epic, but we're kind of doing a sample version of it now, and I'm sort of working on that. I don't know how much details I'm allowed to give about it, but it's something that I really want to make good. I mean, and that's the thing. When I got into this comic book stuff, my art is not strong. And I'm really working towards making it better. Mm-hmm. Penciling I'm pretty good at, but when you get into sort of sequential art, I really struggle with that.
Okay.
You know, so it's been sort of a difficult journey to sort of, you know, find my strengths. And as I've done more and more of Ken's work, I've sort of been finding my stride. So I want this project to sort of be the pinnacle example of that. So I've been working really hard on it. Mm-hmm. And I think once that's done, I want to give a serious attempt to do my own book. I'm really inspired by Michael Nino's anthology series, which of course I can't remember the name of. He's going to get real mad at me for that. But it's got Larva Boy in it.
The Signifiers.
Well, Signifiers is one, but there's...
Oh.
It's a Reactionary Tale.
Yes, Reactionary Tale. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, I was... Yes. That's the other one. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I really want to do a book like that. I have a lot of sort of smaller stories. I think mm-hmm. that's my strength, the smaller stories mm-hmm. That I would like to compile and do a book. And I'd like to just have something to represent myself, like maybe even have a table at one of the shows at some mm-hmm, point, mm-hmm. but
well, you also did the Knicks trading cards, correct? Knicks Comics trading cards, which came out a year ago.
No, that was actually a few weeks ago.
That's right. Okay.
Me and Ken were going to do that signing at the Ogre.
Okay.
Ken said, "Hey, let's." This is Ken's strength, is he's always like, "Hey, let's do something for that, for just that, or let's do something that really sort of the neat little items, neat little things, neat little books and stuff like that." So yeah, he came up with the concept for these cards and then had me, because he wanted to sort of demonstrate, dramatize the sort of mixture of music and horror that he was doing for his book. So, you know, he sort of picked sort of a monster to represent different aspects of the musical genres that he's into mm-hmm. that sort of make up the Knicks books. Mm-hmm. That was fun.
Yeah, cool. all right, well, let's talk. With five creators. Do you want me to go first?
Sure.
Okay, I'll go first because I thought about it.
All right.
If I had the opportunity to, and again, living or dead.
oh, that's good.
Yeah. first would be Starenko.
Okay.
I had a chance, I met him a couple of years ago, and it was really, he's an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. More or less, he's the rock star. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got that aura and persona, but yet he really genuinely cares about you, mm-hmm. which I just, it was weird. And I don't want to, my listeners have heard the story, but it kind of just was really a weird, like, it lasted 5 minutes, but I left and I walked down the aisle and I'm like, what the hell just happened? You know, so I would want to have him again. I think that he would just be fascinating again.
Cool.
I would go with Larry Hama.
Oh, yeah.
Because he is, I mean, without a doubt, he's the father of G.I. Joe.
Absolutely.
Huge part, excuse me, of my childhood. I gravitated towards the books more than the cartoon, and I don't know if that makes me a weird kid or not, but it just the realism just to me hooked me where the cartoon was laughable.
Yeah, I was a big G.I. Joe guy too. I liked the toys and the comics especially.
Yes.
The show was all right, but
exactly.
The comics really expanded on a lot of things.
Oh, it did. To me, as a kid, like, and being 7 or 8 years old, I don't know why it clicked with me, because there were some dark parts to the to those storylines that Larry created. I mean, the whole if you remember Snake Eyes' Eskimo buddy, Quinn was his name. He died. That's and I was heartbroken as a kid. Like, wait a minute, he's dead. And I remember,
people don't die. Now that he's dead, I don't know what to
Yeah,
think about
exactly. That just threw me off. And then the weird, like, backstabbing political world of Cobra was fascinating to me as a kid. You know, because remember they had Billy, which was the bastard son, and then he tried to have the I can't remember which one, the blind master, the hard master killed, and and there was all that was going on, and I found the books to be so much so fascinating.
Yeah.
Just absolutely. And I'm getting off on a tangent. If there was no comic book, I probably wouldn't be reading comics, because that's what got me every month to go. You know, because I had a few here and there. But when I first got G.I. Joe, I'm like, oh my God. And then it was every month, take me down to the drugstore so I can get another one, so I can get the new one. You know, I got to go down and get the new one, and et cetera, et cetera. So, Larry Hama would have to be there. I would probably pick Garth Ennis. I think that Garth Ennis has created some of the more fascinating and interesting characters and stories and universes. And sometimes they're just downright fun. I mean, you know, the murder and mayhem of, and some of his books are just fun. And so I think I would have him. I would have Gail Simone.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of hers, and I think I would like to talk to her about the whole process of being a woman. In a very male-dominated field.
Yeah.
And then lastly, just for levity, maybe to balance out Garth Ennis, I would have Charles M. Schulz.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
he was interesting. There was a lot of interesting themes that he covered, and especially the early Peanuts.
Yeah. And I think as a kid, like, and I didn't realize this till later, Rich, I think I saw myself in Snoopy. Because, again... Snoopy, he was on a doghouse. He wasn't flying a plane, for crying out loud, but in his world, he was.
Right.
And then, in me, you know, being the only kid in the house, you know, this is not the living room. This is where G.I. Joe's going to battle. And, you know what I mean? So I think I identified with him. And I think that Charles Schulz would be a very interesting person to chat with and talk about. Was it just by accident that some of those themes seeped into those strips, or was it premeditated? You know, I think I think he would be interesting to talk with. So those are my five.
Okay, cool. Well, now that you said Charles M. Schulz, I think I would add him to my five, quite frankly, because there was something interesting about the Snoopy-Charlie Brown relationship, because Charlie Brown was just this very lonely kid and never explained why he was bald, but obviously that was sort of symbolic outsider kind of motif. But you know, none of the kids liked him, but he was always trying to push through, and, you know, and Linus was always this weird philosopher who's like, well, Charlie, you might be experiencing this, and yet he himself had his...
Yeah. He had so much anxiety.
Exactly. So he's like the smartest one in the room, and yet he's the most messed up.
Exactly.
And then Snoopy, you think that at least Charlie Brown could connect with Snoopy, and on certain levels he did, but for the most part, Snoopy, like, hey, Charlie Brown, be like me. Be just... cavalier, do what you need, do what you want, live a sort of grand life. But like, especially in the early books, there was a lot of just sort of, these kids were depressed. These kids were like wondering what life was about, and trying to connect with it and trying to understand it and stuff like that. So there's a lot of those interesting, darker themes going on. I guess number two would be Jack Kirby. I really just thought he was a total genius. And at the same time, he seemed like a guy similar to me. I sort of keeps to himself, sort of maybe some social anxiety before it was really diagnosed. He just felt like he was like, well, I'll do what you want, even though I'm a total goddamn genius. I'll be the company man and all this kind of stuff. And you know, you say what you want about Stan Lee, people go back and forth, but I honestly believe if there weren't sort of the Stan Lee sort of out there pitch man, we may not have known that much about Jack Kirby, and Jack Kirby may not have had the career he had. I'm sure that's debatable.
I do. I think I agree with you 100%. He's not on my list because he is. I think he's becoming controversial right now among comic book fans because of the fact that he has kind of, to me, he's kind of gotten to a point where he's like an athlete to an extent. You know, there's a particular time that you can be effective on the football field or the boxing ring or the hockey rink, then quit. And he, I think, has just continued to stick around. And to me, it's like, I would have had more respect for you if you just would have went off into the sunset, man.
Yeah, enjoy your legacy.
Yes, enjoy your legacy. Thank you. Yeah, and so, I mean, and then, you know, as you read more and more about how he worked with other people, like Kirby and like other folks like Jerry, the name's skipping my name, I can't remember. But anyways, how he interacted with them, you know, it is a very complicated and convoluted opinion of Stan Lee now, I think, so... But yeah, Kirby definitely a genius. Definitely the greatest of all time.
And it's just interesting to study him. It's interesting to just keep. I just keep finding something new. I keep finding something interesting. And you know, the guy, he wasn't like he didn't know every muscle. He didn't know shading. He faked it, but he faked it in such an abstract genius way. If that makes any sense. I mean, there's scenes where Captain America's walking this way and there's dudes up, you know, looking at him. But if you really examine the angle, these dudes would be like, have to be leaning over like 90 degrees for this scene to work. But it totally didn't matter. He was sort of creating this sort of, he had this very theatrical lens and this sort of very dramatic lighting. And just the way, you know, the muscles would just be like pointing the action, you know. And every character, what I liked was sort of the battle tableaus, I call them. But every character, like there's this shot of Omak, and he's running through these dudes, these military guys, who's trying to stop him. But every one of those military guys sort of has this little story to tell, has this little struggle. One guy's like upside down.
One guy's running at him.
But they all have these looks on their faces. They're all very personalized. And then there's always this, and it catches me every time, there's this one last guy who's holding on to Omak's foot. Like for dear life. It's like, you know, any current artist might make those shadowy figures faceless nothings, just, you know, fodder. But Kirby added sort of life and presence to each and every one of them, and it's just fascinating to look at all his work, just how prolific and how in depth and how, you know, complicated there are, and what some people would see as a sort of more of a simplistic art. A lot of people see Kirby as like, well, he didn't have sort of
a technicalness to it, you know, like technically sound.
But he was an artist, pure and pure. Yeah. There's some stuff that you could see hanging in museums that he did that were just brilliant.
So we've got Schultz and Kirby.
I've always liked John Byrne.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I fell in love with his stuff, like I say, Fantastic Four, Alpha Flight, and I like sort of his storytelling. And sometimes when I talk about that with people, they're like, no, he's just kind of a dick who doesn't quite understand comics, but I disagree. And he did an interesting series, the Star Trek series of books. Yep. I can't remember who he did that for, but he did like a Bones McCoy book, and he did Pike book, before Enterprise before Kirk and all that stuff. But it was really his Fantastic Four stuff where he was like doing the Trial of Galactus and all this sort of cosmic crazy stuff. And I met him once, and he's a little abrasive, but I do feel like he's a real genius. I like how he sort of, I just like how he, if Kirby's drawing movie scenes, Byrne is drawing like a TV show. Like, every shot is sort of like, you know, at a certain ground level, or he's every panel is part of the story, you know. And I think that's why he came in conflict with Claremont a lot, because Claremont was writing things that Byrne wasn't drawing, and it was causing certain conflicts there. But yeah, I like John Byrne. I would like to hang out with him. And of course, Mike Mignola, who was, I think, the new Jack Kirby. He has taken comic book art and just done his own goddamn thing with it.
Sure.
You know, he's got small lines and blotty inks and very simple shapes. And in fact, as he's gone on and on, it's become so much more sort of abstract and loose. Mm-hmm. But there's always a strength there. It's always weighted down. There's a heaviness to his drawing, even though it's sort of light. And it just seems so effortless, you know, the way he's just able to conjure up these particular scenes or characters and the study he does. He researches the occult and the classic sort of middle age, you know, like fairies and monsters and things like this. He brings a lot of that into his stories, and I think he's a new genius. Is that how many? That's four.
You got one more.
Well, I liked Bill Sienkiewicz, and I think that's pretty sure how you pronounce
it. Yes, that is. I learned how to pronounce it. Oh, I'll tell you off air. I'll tell you, I've learned to pronounce it. Yeah, that's correct.
But he was like the first guy when I was really getting into comics, other than like Barry Windsor Smith. He was doing something so much different.
Yeah, like over the top, yes. And very epic. I know we use that term a lot, but yeah.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, it was like he took like the sort of style of the Neil Adams and just deconstructed it. Mm-hmm. You know, he still had sort of that quick line work and all that kind of stuff, but it was like, it just started, you know, like, I don't know, expanding and growing stranger and all this kind of stuff. So I knew him from when he was doing Moon Knight, when he was still sort of more of a technical guy. Mm-hmm. And then as he moved forward and he went to New Mutants and then he started doing those Daredevil graphic novel and Elektra and stuff like that. Elektra blew my mind. Elektra is what made me really, really inspired me. Like a whole, I even wrote book reports about Bill Sienkiewicz for high school and middle school and stuff like this, just because I found him so ultimately interesting the way he drew. And another sort of classical artistic master, you could sort
May
of.
May I have your attention,
oh,
please?
Oh, there's a thing going on.
It is now 8:30. The library will be closing.
Okay.
Call for a ride home.
Oh,
okay.
Well,
a ride home.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. hey, what can I say? This is what happens when you record live in the Columbus Metropolitan Library.
Yeah.
So, anyways, please disregard that. You can call home if you want, or call for a ride, I suppose. But, anyways, Richie.
And you know, to be honest, if you had those five guys and they weren't even talking to me and just talking to each other, that would be just simply amazing.
Exactly.
Be in that room and understand them or try to understand each other.
Yeah. All right, well, let's talk about where people can get in touch with you.
Oh,
on
really?
The internet.
I don't want them to get in touch with
you. No, you don't want
Well, I have a website called, it's on DeviantArt, if anyone's heard of that.
All right, is that the best place to go, basically? Is that.
Yeah, I think so. That's probably got, you know, the most of what that's where I showcase any most of
Okay, well, there you go. There you go. And I actually have it down. It's
flapjoy.deviantart.com,
and that's where you can go and check you out. All right. Rich.
I hope I didn't sound too stupid.
No, by no means, sir. By no means. I thank you for coming on.
Oh,
appreciate
sure.
it.
Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of this break, I'll be back to wrap up this episode. So, if you will, please stick around. All right, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, my conversation with Rich Trask, and for the first time ever in the history of this podcast, you kind of heard that we were pushing the time limit, huh? We were pushing the time limit. we met up at the library, and apparently we were close to getting kicked out of there, as you heard. I just left it in because, number one, it was funny, and number two, it was really going to be a pain in the neck to edit it out, so
you got to hear a little bit of behind the scenes, if you will, of how the PVD cast is made. So, oh man, but definitely check out Rich over at flapjoy.deviantart.com. And if you're like, I'm not sure how that's spelled or whatever, just go over to the links page at pvdcast.com. There's a link right over there under that tab, and there you have it. Hey, something else I want to talk about real quick, too, is coming up, of course, this weekend, September 17th and September 18th in Franklinton, right here in Columbus, Ohio. Franklinton's, for those that are unaware, it's a neighborhood that sits kind of to the western side of downtown, but it's Independence Day. That's right, man. Lots of cool bands, lots of food trucks, a lot of great art, a lot of cool things going on. And if you're interested, you want to check it out, maybe you're, you know, an hour or so outside of Columbus, maybe you're in the area, you know, because you're going to be here for the weekend anyways, you want to check it out, all you got to do is go to thisisindependent.com. And you'll have all the information as to when, where, why, who, etc., etc. So Independence Day, it's cool. I went down last year, first time ever. And actually, behind the scenes, we were talking about behind the scenes of the PVD, guys. That's where I met Jack Wallace. Anyways, boy, I'm breaking all kinds of rules on this podcast. I'm divulging it all. But anyways, I am looking forward to going down. I don't know what day I'm going to go down, but I'm certainly going to spend some time in Franklinton and check out all the cool things going on at Independence Day. I would also like to mention, because we just touched base with this in the conversation that Rich and I had, Nick's Comics. They got a Kickstarter going on. Ken Epstein would like to put out Nick's Comics Quarterly number 9. As of right now, there's about 3 days remaining in that Kickstarter campaign. If you got a couple extra bucks you want to donate, Ken would appreciate it. Just go over to Kickstarter. Just type in the search engine there, Nick's Comics, N-I-X, Comics, Quarterly 9, and you'll get the cool little video that Ken made, and if you want to donate, you can donate. So, all right, with that being said then, ladies and gentlemen, it's about time for me to wrap this up, so let's get to Orlando's All right, this is where I like to talk about something that I think is cool, something I think is noteworthy, something I think you should check out. And I have it right here in my hands, actually. It's going to be music-related. I like music. I've talked about it on previous episodes of this podcast. I just got, just borrowed, actually. I didn't purchase it yet, but I just borrowed from a friend of mine the new album from Young the Giant. It's entitled Home of the Strange, and I really enjoyed Young the Giant's first album, which I believe is self-entitled. I really liked it. Well, they certainly have followed up with a very strong second album, Home of the Strange. Very good, very good. I highly recommend it. Actually, I also recommend that you check out Young the Giant on YouTube. Google their cover of R. Kelly's Ignition. Oh, it's phenomenal. It's really well done. And from what I understand, I've never had the privilege to see Young the Giant in concert. From what I understand, that is a staple of their encore, is doing Ignition by R. Kelly. So there you go. That's my fave for this edition of the PVD Cast, Young the Giant's new album, Home of the Strange. You should definitely check it out. All right, with that, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk about where you can get in touch with me. If you need to get in touch with me, you can shoot me an email, johnorlando@pvdcast.com. You can find me on Twitter at PVDMVP. I'm also available on Instagram on that same username, PVDMVP. Hey, as always, this podcast is available to you through PVDcast.com, the online home of yours truly. It's also available through iTunes, through Stitcher, through Google Play, through SoundCloud. So there's five different ways that you can get this podcast. So all you got to do, though, is do me a favor. I don't care how you're getting it, but just tell some people about it, all right? Tell some people. I'm having a great go here this past summer, and I want to carry it on into this fall, keep that momentum going. So tell some friends about the PVD Cast. And, you know, if you're listening on iTunes, subscribe, rate, review. That would help me a little bit. So with that being said, I'm going to shove off here. So I will chat at each and every one of you
later. Thanks for listening, folks.